Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is composer Paul Chahara. Chahara is a composer who works for the concert stage, ballet, scores, Broadway, film, and television. He studied with the renowned compositional teacher Nadia Boulanger in Paris, as well as Gunther Schuller at Tanglewood. He was the first composer in residence with the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, as well as of the San Francisco Ballet for nearly a decade. He's currently on the music faculty at UCLA, where he heads up their visual media department. Chahara has also written nearly 100 scores for films and television, including the cult classic Death Race 2000. That was his first film score in 1974. He's also worked with directors Louis Malle, Michael Ritchie, and Arthur Penn. His movie credits include Prince of the City, The Morning After, and Crossing Delancey. His television credits include China Beach, Simon and Simon, and Magruder. He also composed the score for The Shogun, the musical based on James Clavell's novel. One of Chahara's early television movie scores was Farewell to Manzanar, a TV movie depicting the Japanese internment camps during World War II. A story very close to him as he was interned in a camp in Minidoka in his early childhood. Before we speak with him, let's hear music from one of his chamber works titled Minidoka. The music of Paul Chahara here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center. It's open to the public, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Paul Chahara, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Your career has been very interesting because in a day and age where we tend to pigeonhole anybody in the arts, you're a film actor, you're a television actor, in music, you are a pop musician, or you are a classical composer, or a film composer. You've managed to do a great variety of things, from doing Broadway, from doing 100 television and film series, film scoring and TV scoring, to classical works. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I wanted to make a living, for one thing, and I wanted to make it as a composer. I was born in 1938, and in Seattle, Washington. Those of us who come from Seattle, Washington, in 1938, we were in the back wall. We were close to Alaska. I don't know how you feel about it if you were born and raised in Tulsa, but believe me, being born and raised in Seattle in that generation, we had to make an effort if we wanted to follow our dream. And I always loved movies, and I always loved music. I'm sure that's the only talent that I have. I'll never know because I never tried to be anything else. And that's a blessing. So for me, having decided early in life or just recognized that this is all I could and wanted to do, anything within that domain was pleasure for me. It was like a sandbox. You know, any corner of the sandbox gave pleasure.
Now, did you ever run into resistance from people who said, "Well, you write classical music, or you're writing TV."
I ran into it all the time, but it never bothered me because the biggest resistance was always my own insecurities, and to be honest, to some degree, the somewhat displeasure of my parents. Remember, I'm Japanese. That is Japanese-American. They, coming from Japan, expected me to be a respectable person. And in Japan, particularly of that generation, a musician was never a respectable person. I don't know if people know this, but kabuki theater, which is so venerated, right? In Japan, this started as a form of prostitution.
Right.
I don't want to draw a connection between that and my career, but... But in the eyes of others who were trying to nurture a young...
I think anybody who's been in the music business can say there's a little bit of similarities
right.
from time to time.
Yes, and you're a musician. You know what I'm speaking about. But the other thing I have to mention is that I grew up in a relocation camp, in a Japanese-American
That's
relocation
right.
camp. Having been born in 1938, of course, you know your history, and so that meant that I, being on the West Coast, didn't grow up like other American kids.
How did that affect you? I mean, it had to have a profound effect on your childhood, the whole way you relate to...
It had a great effect on me as an artist, I'm sure of it. And as a person, no doubt. But remember, I was the youngest of four kids. And it was harder on them, looking back, and very hard on my parents who were separated. You know, my father was a sensei, a teacher of martial arts, as well as a jeweler. He was a leader of the Japanese community. So he was taken away first during the duration. Their experiences were difficult. Although they never complained. They never talked to us about it. It's the old Japanese spirit, you know. But what it meant for me was that the wartime, I think of it as a crucible of my creative life. And
did you have access to a piano?
It wouldn't have mattered because I'm not a very good pianist. I have a very good ear. I play the violin very well, but in the relocation camp, I sang. And every Saturday we had a canteen. That's what we called it, what we American kids called it. And we'd get together and perform for each other. Mostly the older people would play the shamisen or the bonodori, which is dancing. And I sang, but since I was an American kid, I didn't sing. I spoke Japanese as a child, and I could sing songs like Shina no yoru, shina no yoru yo. But I never sang that. I sang things like my mama done told me when I was in knee pants, which is hilarious because I was in knee pants. So given that background, you can see that for me, music was always a form of entertainment and also a form of getting good attention as opposed to being hated as the enemy.
Yeah.
And the other thing I have to remind you, you're a lot younger than I am, I can see, Rich, but the only upside to getting older, there is no upside to getting older, but the only thing that I might give myself consolation is that I remember certain things that are part of my reality that not everybody else shares, and among them is the music of that era. Now, we had radio, of course, no television, obviously, no movies to speak of, but radio. And that meant I was hearing the greatest music ever composed in any era, particularly in America.
Meaning Duke Ellington,
Glenn Miller, and these wonderful groups that are less well-known now, like the Dorsey bands, but who are classics, great musicians, fabulous arrangements. And I grew up with them. You know, I have a great memory, a perfect pitch. I, as a child, this information was flooding me and giving me pleasure that never occurred to me that I was a somehow persecuted minority. Mm. As a child, I was never allowed to, I never felt that way.
So the great big bands and also the great American songbook, I would think.
All of that music, and it's embedded in my memory. And that is the common denominator. And if you look, for example, to this song, many of the pieces that you'll hear of mine, even though they're for, say, Cleveland Orchestra, I just had a commission with them, Boston Symphony and so forth. If you listen to them, you're going to hear things, gee, that sounds like Doris Day or some song, you know? And it's because my memory, and I think that's why I was very early in my career, already back in the late 70s, called a postmodern, one of the first composers to be given that title, because people were beginning to see that my music was constantly referential. George Crumb, who is older than I, but a good friend of mine, we were among the people who tried to find a musical language that was personal. There were only two kinds of music being written in the late 70s, as you know, 12-tone music and completely tonal music, nothing else. And the divide academically, commercially, was severe. You had to make a choice.
You were probably running into a lot of resistance from your teachers because a lot of those teachers were saying, look, that music is dead.
Yeah, people did say that, but you know what? I didn't have a lot of teachers. And that's one of the advantages to growing up in Seattle and maybe growing up in Tulsa. You know, I grew up like a little wild Indian boy. Minidoka, which was our relocation camp, was another name for a reservation. I'm sure that I was like an Indian child, or I shouldn't say that. I was the original American native. So there are blessings. And I was allowed very early to see music as a form of pleasure and fun. Maybe it was escape, too. It doesn't matter. For me, it was the only thing I really wanted to do and the only skill that I've developed.
Well, it's interesting that you said, you know, I was really going against the grain by wanting to put tunes and melodies in this.
Yes.
That obviously made you attractive to film and television because that's where you wrote tonal music.
Well,
for a symphony.
No, you're absolutely right about that. But here's the interesting thing. I didn't know I could write tonal music because when I finally decided to become a composer as opposed to a violinist, as a child, I played the violin. I was on television, a child, you know. I was in a USO troop, by the way. This is one of the ironies, like growing up in a relocation camp. And then as a teenager, being in a USO troop, entertaining our GI brothers and sisters during the Korean War. I love that about America, you know. So anyway,
The past is like 5 minutes ago.
That's right. And then, of course, during the Vietnam War and shortly thereafter, I wrote that wonderful show called China Beach, which was about Vietnam. It seems like all my life I've been haunted by these experiences in which people deal with something like a foreign war and have to come to terms with it in a normal civilian life.
We should mention that's one of your big series that you did, China Beach.
Yes.
I want to ask you about writing for television, because that is, you know, you think of a film having strong deadlines. Television, it's just, it's like running a sprinting marathon.
Yes. In fact, I was, when I've done a lot of movies before I was working at Universal, and they said, do you think you can do a series? And I said, well, I think so. The first show I did was for CBS. It was called Whiz Kids. It was about these kids who go into computers and things. And it was quite successful, that show. It won its time slot, which was the criteria in those days by the network to see if your show was going to continue or not. Right. Anyway, I remember my producer was a friend of mine with whom I had worked before, said, you know, he's got to work really hard. Well, I discovered it wasn't hard work for me. I discovered that I write really fast. Well, I mean, I knew that all along. By the way, I never told my producers that, because I'm giving away some secrets now that I'm an old man. If there are any young composers out there, never tell the producer you finished a score, because he will come and he'll meddle with it and drive you crazy. That's the way producers are, you know.
Right.
So I never told him, even though I usually had the score finished right after we spotted it. Within an hour, I knew what the main theme was going to be. When I looked at a picture, I could hear the tune in my head. And I gave myself permission to write it down. You know, I think as a teacher, since I'm here as an educator, one of the things I've discovered, in order to unlock a composer, I don't try to give them ideas. Nobody can. God gives that to us. I can't give that to anybody. Usually the kids have it, or else they wouldn't even be in my class or in my private studio, right? Mm-hmm. What I try to do is unlock it. Take away those people that say, thou shalt not write a tonal piece, thou shalt not. You know, all of these sort of strictures, I think, inhibit creativity. So one of my joys is to take away the things that inhibit you from being creative. And there were a lot of those when I was growing up, and there still are. You know, the academic side to the arts has taken over what used to be, you know, there are no Esterházys anymore. There are no Mademoiselle von Mecks. There are no people who give money to Tchaikovsky or Haydn. There are universities and foundations and things like that.
And there are no jazz clubs, for example, where musicians learn their craft by actually being in front of an audience and for money and getting booed off the stage.
And it's interesting you should say that, because jazz is the least commercial, the least viable form of music in the world right now. In Hollywood, they would rather that I gave them an Ethiopian hip-hop score for kids in suburbia than jazz. Jazz immediately means to the listening audience, especially people under 25, which is our audience, by the way, it tells them that this is a dated, old-fashioned score, and they'll turn off the show or change the channel.
Wow.
It's jazz. And so people who went to jazz, like people at North Texas State, probably heard Tulsa and so forth, or in Austin, flourishing cross between jazz and country western or whatever, those people are like the classical musicians of the 18th century. You know, they're doing it for the pure creative fun of it.
Yeah. My guest today is Paul Chihara, composer of film and television, of classical music, as well as Broadway scores. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center. He's a guest of the University of Tulsa School of Music, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We talked about you spending some time in a Japanese relocation camp during World War II. Mm. Your very second film and television score was Farewell to Manzanar, which was the first publication since the war, you know, relocation stories.
When I spoke years later, I gave a lecture. I was freelancing. I wasn't at the UCLA or any of the California schools, but I gave a lecture at some of the California schools, among them UCLA. And, you know, there were 300 people, I remember, in Schoenberg Auditorium for this lecture. And people were really moved by it, you know. It was in 1989. It was considerably after the period, right? But backstage, the people who were most offended by it were Japanese-American students of third and fourth generation. They said, Mr. Chihara, how could you show that embarrassing picture? We never saw so many angry Japanese. I mean, here were generations of kids trying to assimilate, and that meant for them distancing themselves from the trauma of and many of them didn't even know what that trauma was.
Right, I would think it was like, you're telling some alien story.
Right. And they were embarrassed by it, like I was singling them out, whereas they were doing a very good job of becoming comfortable. So I don't know if it's still that way. That was 20 years ago, but even that 20 years ago was 20 years after the war.
Well, we'll talk about working on that film because, again, it was a TV movie, so again, tight deadlines, I'm sure.
It was a it was a movie of the week for NBC, which, believe it or not, at that time was the leading network. I think CBS is now, but in those days it was. This was before Freddie Silverman and ABC and all those jiggly TV shows came in the 70s. If you're older than you look, you'll know what I'm talking about. But NBC then was the great network, and it was done at Universal. So it was a major network. Remember, there was no cable then. There were only three networks. And so if you got on one of those, especially on NBC, it was going to have a huge following, which it did. What was important about it was the network and the studio wanted us to cast all of the characters with Caucasians. Now, this may sound very Uncle Tom to you, but remember, this was the standard. For example, one of the most popular movies just a few years before that was Breakfast at Tiffany's. And of course, there was a hateful character played by Mickey Rooney, not an unpopular character, playing a Japanese person with buck teeth and all the sorts of stereotypes that we hate. It was worse than Stepan Fitchett or Amos and Andy.
And there were a number of, now that I think about it, were a number of character actors that specialized.
Let me remind you, Marlon Brando in Tea House of the August Moon played a geisha boy with his eyes taped up. The other was Alec Guinness in, what is that, Party of Two, I think it was called, with Rosalind Russell. I may have gotten the title a little wrong.
Vito Scotti was a great character actor, Italian character actor who always played very broad character.
I won't use the three-letter word, but it's like the N-word, you know, and that was incendiary. But we got used to seeing us. And not just Japanese, by the way, but all Asians, Chinese, Korean. There were almost no Koreans in America when I was a kid. But these minorities were typified by people who were not Asians. Now, nobody would think of doing that today, but it was a huge breakthrough. And the only way we could get it was that our director was John Cordy, whom had just scored a huge success with a movie called The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman.
Right.
Now,
Cicely
this was very Tyson, important. Yeah. Yes. He was at, and because he won like 7 Emmys, he could insist on it. He was married to a Korean girl, by the way. Anyway, I mentioned that Miss Jane Pittman because that was the era. It was the late 70s when everybody was talking about Roots. Remember the huge TV series based on the book. And so people were going back to their ethnic. It's funny, the Japanese Americans were the ones who didn't want to, probably because relocation set this minority apart in a way that made them ashamed. But there were, for example, people of Jewish American descent whose parents coming through Ellis Island had changed their names from Kovacevic to Smith, who were now changing them back again. Some very famous examples of musicians did that. So given that era, it was a little easier for them to break through. And the result was this movie was cast entirely with people who have since become the first generation of Asian American performers in Hollywood. Like, for example, Pat Morita, who was the Karate Kid, you know, the master of that and so forth. Then you'll see Clyde Kusatsu. These names may mean nothing to your listeners, but if you see them, you'll see immediately, as I've seen them 1,000 times.
Right. What was it like composing the score? Did you think back to your days?
Yes. That was the easiest score to write ever because it depicted a life that I knew very well, that I grew up in. And the music, I did not try to make it sound false Japanese. There are Japanese tunes in it, which I was able to get because I was working at UCLA for a couple of years then. And at that time, they had a terrific ethnomusicology institute with Japanese department. Those musicians all went back to the Imperial Court Orchestra in Tokyo eventually in a couple of years. But at that time, I had their services, and we could do wonderful Japanese music. But I put that music in as source music. The music that I wrote as underscore and that the kids were singing was entirely in the Glenn Miller era. And it was easy for me to write. I have to tell you something, though. The first movie I ever did was just before that, called Death Race 2000 for Roger Corman.
Which has become a cult classic.
Now, I knew nothing about writing music then. I was already the composer in residence with the LA Chamber Orchestra and the San Francisco Ballet, so I knew how to write classical music, right? And I worked with the LA Philharmonic with Zubin Mehta. But being a child of that era, I wrote 12-tone music. And that's what got me to Tanglewood, what got me my credentials as a member of the avant-garde and as a legitimate classical composer, right, as you said. Mm-hmm. But that's not who I was. That's who I became in order to be successful. Even as a kid, I knew that there were certain things you did. When I got my first job from Roger Corman to do Death Race 2000, up until that point, a lot of people find this hard to believe, but it can be proven by looking at my publications. I had never written a tonal piece in my life other than exercises in school, you know, like a fugue or something. No. And so I didn't know that I could write a tonal piece. Not only was I writing tonal music, but I was writing it to a girl who was nude on screen. I didn't know I could do that. Remember, this was the early 70s. So this was a very permissive era, and for many people, exciting. For me, too, to be honest.
What was it like to work with Roger Corman?
It was wild. I've worked with him several times since then. I Never Promised You a Rose Garden.
Yeah.
Tidal Wave, a whole bunch of things. He was, as we Japanese say, he was a ganef. You know, he was. He paid me almost nothing, and he had all of us doing unspeakable acts, like voice-overing movies that he had just brought from Japan or from the Philippines, and to turn them into American movies with our voiceovers, which of course he didn't pay us for. But looking back, I shouldn't say all of this, but it's true. But looking back, that man gave me something that was priceless. He gave me a career, because even though it's true I didn't make much money, I actually lost money. But when we finished it, I had a separate card on screen, music by Paul Chihara. I wasn't somebody's hoe. I wasn't somebody's assistant. I got a separate card. And it was my first credit on the IMDb. And from that moment, from 1975 until now, I haven't stopped working. So Roger, wherever you are, I put you up. And there are a lot of us out there who say the same thing.
Right.
Like my student, James Horner, and Jack Nicholson, just to name two. Spectacular. Francis Ford Coppola, who was here in
Yeah, that's right.
In
and
Tulsa.
Did you come to Tulsa when you were working on Rumblefish?
I did. Yes, of course. In fact, this is very strange. I hadn't even thought about Tulsa. That was 30 years ago. It was 1982. Until I arrived at the airport, and Joseph Rivers, my colleague and gracious chairman of the department here, picked me up at the airport and was driving me. And I thought, as I was driving in, I thought, I've been here before. And it was the most haunting experience. The buildings are all different. I didn't see the skyline is quite different from 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But there's something about the area that immediately I could feel it, the way the houses are. We went by a building that looked like an abandoned apartment building or a school. It was like Zoetrope. I think that Francis somehow got one free or something. It was a big building. It's like
a high
school.
He pretty much set up shop here for a couple of years.
Oh, he did a lot of things here. Yeah. One from the Heart, The Outsiders, all those Hinton. You know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And everybody in the world, they were unknown at the time, like Nicolas Cage and
Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise was in The Outsiders.
They were all here. They were doing unspeakable acts, but they were all
Yes, they were. Well, my guest today is Paul Chihara, composer of film and television, of classical music. And I read this story. It was a review of one of your piano trios, and it's based on Bill Withers' Ain't No Sunshine.
Ain't No Sunshine.
I actually have the music here. Yeah. What was the inspiration for that?
Well, that's actually the inspiration of all my music. Everything, when I hear music, I hear the music that I love, which is almost always pop music. Mm-hmm. I worked in not only television, but I worked on Broadway. I was the arranger for one of the arrangers and the music supervisor for Sophisticated Ladies, mm-hmm. which we went through 80 songs of Duke Ellington's, 80, produced them, and in the process of the various tryouts, Kennedy Center and so forth, many of them were cut away. So when the show opened, it had 44. That's still a lot of numbers. And if you orchestrate and produce 80 songs, you really know the composer. Yeah. So those are the things that are second nature to me. If there's any composer listening to me, a young composer, I want to say this. Music should be fun, should not be work. You know that mantra, no pain, no gain? Maybe that's true if you want to be a weightlifter. It's not true if you want to be an artist. So that's the very subversive thing to say for a music educator, but do what the heart and the tells you, and it'll probably be good.
You will do occasional film projects today, but really your work is in back into classical music.
I'm doing a lot
and it's really, it's like the music has come back to you in many ways. You know,
but what's interesting is as I'm now going back into classical music, it sounds more popular than ever before because now I'm at that stage in my life and in my career where I don't have to apologize. I no longer have to try to hide the fact that I'm a film composer. I never did, by the way, but I felt the intimidation that I remember when I did my first picture, Death Race 2000, that there were people, and it was in one of the headlines in the Los Angeles Times was Chihara Goes Hollywood. This was pejorative to say Goes Hollywood. That was like saying you sold out. Mm-hmm. Now there are people, if there are young people listening to me, going Hollywood is what many people want to do, including people like Jeremy Irons or, Kenneth Branagh, people who can do the real thing and to do this other real thing.
Well, and in fact, probably once you were well-established in film and television, the snootiness factor was going back the other way.
That's true. And here's the other thing is, I am still working in Hollywood. I did a picture with John Turturro recently. Well, not recently, means 3 years ago.
It was a musical, wasn't
cigarettes.
It?
That's right. And before that, I did two movies with Sidney Lumet for HBO. But the reason why they're less well-known, say, than Farewell to Manzanar or something, has something to do with industry, not so much with me. Composers play a different kind of role in films now. We're much more part of the script and the production. And the producers themselves are to some degree not only directing, but sometimes even composing the scores. And I'm not just referring to Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm. They give us scores that they produced sometimes with their own garage band in their own computers. Everybody now is computer literate.
Or it's a CD or a score with existing music already.
And that existing music is not just a guide as it used to be. It is now the mandate. They say, yeah. Rip that off. I won't quote who said that, but I had a director who said, rip that off.
That's got to be somewhat soul-deadening in a way. I mean, is it just the nature of the beast?
Well, you know what? Soul-deadening is not working. And you know what? It's a whole new world now. Like, I worked at Disney my last studio gig was at mm-hmm. Disney. There are no studio gigs now. I wasn't fired. It just disappeared.
Right.
All the studios, you know. The buildings are there, and you can go there as a tourist and, you know, buy a T-shirt. But I was doing those movies from Japan, immensely famous movies, popular movies for especially younger people by Miyazaki called, for example, Kiki's Delivery Service, the first picture that I mm-hmm. did in this collaboration. And my team won the Academy Award for the Miyazaki picture, but our Buena Vista version of it called Spirited Away. This connection between Ghibli Studios in Tokyo and Buena Vista in Los Angeles, that is a world-shaking kind of, you know what that is? That's Pearl Harbor in reverse. Think about that. Now, you may think, oh, wow, this is nothing. You know, just making a movie. No, it's major because Walt Disney represents to most of the world, like Coca-Cola, our culture and our values. Ghibli is that one form of animation that challenges Disney, and Disney themselves recognize it.
They can't do it. Yeah, it's alien.
Ghibli's animations represent a whole different way of looking at animation, which is to say it is not the cutesy sort of thing. Just it is not a Never Never Land. If you look at his movies, they're filled with terror, with fascism, but that's one of his things, you know, yeah. Destroying the universe and things like that. You know, that sort of thing doesn't come up in Bambi. You know, there is sort of in Bambi. That's not a good example I chose, since it's predations of man against nature. But this.
The Little Mermaid, maybe.
Right. So, and the result is that Disney itself has changed somewhat lately. If you look at the last movie they made before we made this alliance was Mulan. Mm-hmm. Very lovely score by Jerry Goldsmith, my good friend. The score the movie did very poorly in the box office. The very next one was Tarzan. And if you look at the animation, it's quite different. It's not those cutesy pictures anymore with those big, sweet eyes, you know.
Right.
They're starting to look a little scarier. And now, no animation would ever go back to that kind of Snow White kind of prettiness. Even the scary people.
The doe eyes, if you will.
The doe eyes, exactly right. That won't. And even the scary people. Well, I mean, the Wicked Witch in Snow White is a pretty scary character, of course, for a child especially. But it's still saccharine enough so that unless you're really young, you're not going to be intimidated. But some of the images coming out of animation now are truly scary. They're like nightmares.
Yeah.
You know. So all of that happened recently, and as my role, I was in that role of trying to bring these things together because I was a composer, and I did less composing than I would have done if it were Death Race 2000. But that's what a musician does these days in this digital age, and with so much material available to us through television and internet mostly.
Yeah.
We do different sorts of things now. It's not so much what we create as what we, well, it's not so much, we create it by combining things. It's as if postmodernism is part of everybody's thinking now. We won't even use that word anymore. It's just the way
the whole industry of film rights for existing music has changed.
Give me a break.
Yeah,
it's
like you're competing against the whole over of Western music from the beginning to time till now.
Rich, remember what I said, because this came from a very famous, and I'm going to mention him. I'm not going to mention his name, director. Rip it off.
Well, you can hear more of Paul Chihara tonight at 7 o'clock as he gives a lecture at the Lorton Performance Center. Paul Chihara, thanks very much for joining
us. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Composer Paul Chihara speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at 7 at the Lorton Performance Center. It's free and open to the public. We leave you with more music by composer Chihara.